This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Night has fallen on Arthouse Legends and something sinister lurks in the shadows. Three geeks and their guests will look on the critically acclaimed terrors of cinema and judge their worth. Settle your spine and watch your step as you trespass into
the Art House of Horror.
Welcome to the podcast so good it falls off the bone. This is the movie dude Eric, and along with me are...
Hey, this is Kent, and I just had some great...
Hey, this is Chris, and my brother makes good head cheese.
In this episode, we're discussing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, starring Marilyn Burns, Alan Danziger, Paul A. Partain, William Vale, Terry McMinn, Edward Neal, Gunnar Hansen, and directed by Toby Hooper. Well, earlier this year, we talked about a little movie called The Night of the Living Dead, and that was pretty much the opener for the new kind of horror film that would basically overtake the 70s and move all the way up until modern day. But this movie is the one that really gets all the credit for that revolution. Out of curiosity, how familiar are you with this franchise and with this particular movie?
I never saw it before.
Have you heard of it before?
Oh, of course. I've heard of it, and even heard of Leatherface and his weird recipes.
So how were you made aware of Leatherface and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
I just think it was just culture. Word got away from it.
Was this something you found on the playground, or...?
I think just maybe clips here and there on TV and just people talking about, oh, we're going to go see Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's like, really? Where? VHS. It's like, what's that?
What about you, Chris?
Yeah, I've seen all of the Texas Chainsaw Massacres except the newest one. And I don't remember the first time I saw this one. I think it was right around the time, probably like 10 years ago, I want to say. And yeah.
When were you made aware of Leatherface and kind of this move? Was it before you saw it, or was it at the time that you saw it?
I think it was before, because, like, Leatherface is, like, one of the most popular. Because, like, Freddy and Jason are, like, the big ones, and then Michael Myers. And then they usually throw, like, Pinhead or Leatherface as that fourth, you know? So it was always, like, he was there, but it just took me a while to get them, I guess.
Now, for me, when it comes to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's a tiered response, because honestly, the first time I'd even heard of this, it was in an old rental place where they had the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. And I don't know if you've ever seen the VHS cover for that, but it looked kind of weird and it looked kind of goofy. And of course, being a Texas boy, anything with the word Texas in it just finds its way everywhere. So that was how I was made aware of this franchise, but I didn't actually really kind of get into it until about, I want to say, 1999, when the first McFarlane toys, they had just come out with the first wave, and I just came across this particular one. It was, you know, Freddy, Jason, Leatherface, and I want to say Pumpkin or Chucky or one of those.
I think it was Pumpkin.
We'll go with Pumpkinhead because he's better than Chucky. So.
Yeah.
Not a Chucky fan, I see. But that does. But the thing was, is that I saw this movie, I want to say around 1999, 2000, and then I saw the sequel, which I'm going to just say right now is a really bad movie, but gloriously bad. It's one of those that you don't put it on the same par as the original, but let's just put it this way. As a spoof movie, you can't get any better. But But I guess the question at this particular point comes because, you know, Leatherface is considered to be of the pantheon of slasher killers. And he's kind of the granddaddy. He's the first one, unless you want to count Norman Bates. But where does he stand with you? And what do you make of Leatherface as a slasher in this movie, as one of the original slasher films?
He is pretty sick. So
I'm actually going to disagree with that, but we'll get into that just a little bit.
Well,
I mean, he is definitely freaky looking. You definitely have that. But what about you, Chris? It sounds like you're a fan of the franchise.
Franchise is a strong word. I always think I hate the first one until I watch it, and then it's like, no, I kind of like it. So, like, I like the first one. The rest, I did not like at all. I remember liking the remake when I first saw it, and I wanted to keep it at that. I don't want to revisit it because I'm sure it's terrible now. But, like, everything in between, I've only seen, like, once. I want to say once. So I don't remember much about it. But when it comes to, like, slashers and all the big-time guys, there's only, like, two or three good ones in there anyway. So I guess it kind of balances out.
Well, the thing is that Texas Chainsaw Massacre as a franchise is definitely a very flawed franchise. Outside of the original, I don't know. I think that anyone who tries to get their hands on this is trying to recapture lightning in a bottle, and they don't understand what makes the original so good. And we're definitely going to get into that as we talk about the film itself. But as for Leatherface as a character, let's be honest here. The mental image of Leatherface is very strong, especially in this particular film. Just kind of the look that he has, the impending figure, the how tall he is, and kind of the way he moves. And one thing I really appreciate about it is when I first saw the figure of Leatherface, I thought it was this cruel and vicious and, I mean, kind of Freddy and Jason type. When you watch the film, you get a whole different idea of this character, that it's almost kind of a contrast to the image as to what the character is, right? Do you kind of get there being a dichotomy of sorts?
I mean, he is, do get an impression of him strong. I don't get the, I get this impression of him being a bitch-ish, maybe, that didn't develop, his development is down and not quite right.
Right.
And he's just told, yeah, anybody walks in that you don't recognize, just feel free to cut him up, chop him up, and... Because that's literally what he does. He just lets people go into the house, and he's like, oh,
no, no, he doesn't
delivery.
Let people come into the house.
He doesn't like them to come in, yeah.
Oh, no.
They just leave that shit unlocked, man, and they just walk, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's the middle of nowhere. I mean, this is back in the 70s. I mean, you know, in rural Texas, you didn't leave your doors locked, especially if you're, you know, in the middle of nowhere. That's not how Texas does things. But another thing that I find very interesting about this movie, especially in kind of, and this is the thing that first made me kind of love the movie when I first saw it, is that especially in the early parts of the film, you get this feeling like the whole film was made by just a whole bunch of college students and like two bottles of ketchup, right?
Yeah.
that's kind of the feel it has, right? Like just a very uber independent film. You'd almost to call there to actually be a crew to this film would be putting it very, very mildly. Or this is a whole bunch of friends doing this. Or I kind of got that feeling when I first saw it, but. It sounds like you're kind of familiar with some of the background of this. What did you make of the background?
It seemed exactly like let's get our friends, or let's get some people, let's hire some people, and let's just go out in the hot Texas sun, which just in itself seems like, okay, can we keep our day short? No, we're going to be out there constantly.
Well, it was shot over the course of, what, maybe like 2 weeks?
I want to say there are some reshoots that happen later on, but apparently the guy playing Leatherface never changed out of his clothing the whole time because they wanted to maintain continuity and just realism with any splatters that might occur. So he was just always in that outfit, never
the
washing
it. The great Gunnar Hansen.
Never washing this outfit for 2 weeks under that hot sun, and it's not a thin outfit either.
Mm-mm.
Well, at least so, it makes them run away from him, you know, so...
Yeah, yeah. It's just... Well, yeah.
They weren't running away because of the chainsaw, they were running away from the smell.
Yeah, I think he wanted to run away from himself.
Bit of both, really just a bit of both.
You almost wonder if his little dance at the end is, yay, I'm done, we can all take a shower and wash this, yay.
I'm pretty sure he could take a shower, I mean, it's not like
he's got a handsome
face.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, the thing is, especially with this opening, it feels extremely independent, right? I mean, even sound quality to an extent sounds like they're using a lot of natural sounds. You don't get a whole lot of process. You don't. There's not a very strong ADR element to it. Are y'all kind of getting these vibes?
Which is kind of good, because if you really don't know, it can sound worse than just using ADR. So.
Well, let's not forget, though, that this film was basically designed for the drive-in circuit.
Yeah.
This was...
And it kind of feels like it should... It feels like something I should watch in the screen.
And honestly, I'm going to put it out here right now. I know this is going to be kind of controversial, but if it weren't for the fact that the mob was involved, this probably would be stuck on the drive-in circuit. You know, I have a feeling that as soon as mob money was involved, it was going to get a New York premiere, which of course means you're going to get New York critics.
Yeah.
And that's where this film really sets itself apart from its brother. Because as soon as the critics came out, and as soon as the critics responded to it, these are the same critics that had kind of a very deep divide when it came to Night of the Living Dead. But now they've had a couple of years to kind of get over it, kind of get into it, right?
And now they get something even more fake.
But is it, though? I mean,
some parts, yes. Some parts, no. Some parts were intentionally not as graphic as it could be.
But here's the thing, though. One of the things that I admire about the film is, when I say that they were using two bottles of ketchup, that was literally the amount of blood that they had in the film.
Yeah.
Two pints of blood was used in this film. But your mind, in the way that they use camera angles and they use what they don't show, makes you think that there's a lot more in this movie than there really is. It was also the same thing about the infamous knife sequence that we talked about in Psycho, if you remember that conversation that we had about that. Like, you think that you see a lot more violence, but you never see blood in that scene at all. And the same element was kind of used, and a lot of it was because of the budget. They didn't have the budget to go uber gore. Nor do I think that they, if they had the budget for it, would they have used it? Because, well, let's be honest here. Up to this time, we didn't see many violent films. In fact, I want to say the most violent film up to this point was The Wild Bunch.
Well, wasn't Toby Hooper, like, trying to avoid an R rating, too?
Yes, he actually kind of wanted G.
Yeah.
So,
he was aiming for a PG because he also, one of the things I admire about what Toby Hooper was trying to go for with this is that he was trying to show realistic violence. You know, and that's something that whenever we talk about the violence in the film, one thing that you can't say about it is that it feels inauthentic. We don't get, you know, superhero theatrics, and we don't get, you know, one hit kills here, right? I mean, even the first kill with the sledgehammer. One of the images that will haunt me to this day about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the twitching.
Some awesome twitching, though. It's really awesome.
That sells it, though, because if he just got knocked out by the hammer, you know, I think part of us would probably just say, well, he was just knocked out. You know, he got conked on the head, you know, the Looney Tunes defense, right? Mm-hmm. But the fact that he's twitching like that,
That's bad. Yeah.
No, that means that there was a lot more violence involved. And that's what I'm talking about when I say that that a lot of the violence that is shown is you perceive it as worse, not because of the gore, but because of the after effect, right? But before we get into the actual kills and we get into the violence itself, let's talk about these characters, though, especially our van hippies. What do we think about these guys going into this? Now, one thing I found myself interested in whenever I hear conversations about this film is a lot of people are divided. A lot of people find them to be very unlikable. Some find them to be realistic. Where do you fall on this?
I'm going to say one thing. I know during Night of the Living Dead, I was ragging on Barbara's bitch ass. That's fine. I would take a movie full of Barbaras over fucking Franklin.
Oh.
Oh, God, I had a feeling that we're going to go into Franklinville.
Oh.
Franklin.
Fucking Franklin.
We talked about Pinhead for a second there. I would take all of Pinhead's pleasures over an eternity with Franklin.
I would give all my money to see that movie.
Except I have met friends so many times. They just want to tell you an exquisite detail of something that you know is, oh, I think this is interesting. Now I'm going to make you squirm, and I'm going to think it's funny.
All I can say is, as I was watching this character, this time around, all I could think of was Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder.
You think they only tolerate the character because he's the brother of one of the wolves?
Well, not only that, but, I mean, if we don't forget the John Larroquette opener, outright calls out Sally and Franklin. So Franklin was, they made a big deal out of Franklin being one of the people that were in the van. Yeah. And, of course, the horrors that are the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But
he does have the best kill, though, so there's that.
Yeah.
Yet we don't actually see what happens to him. We see the back.
You don't see it, yeah.
Yeah, but you know he ate a fucking chainsaw in his fucking gut, though. That dude is gone.
Oh, yeah.
But that's the beauty of what this film does, is that you see the chainsaw, you see where the chainsaw is pointing, you see the back of Franklin, you see him twitch and basically get torn up from behind, but you don't see blood, you don't see intestines, you don't see anything like that. You just see him twitch. And that's all that you have, and of course the sound effect of the chainsaw. That's all you have to sell you on the fact that Franklin's getting a gut full of chainsaw.
That's an right? art. I mean, that's an art in itself, though. Like the not showing it, but still like your brain piecing it together is like something movies today, horror movies today, are lacking like big time, and it's something I miss like crazy. Because now everything's just like, oh. This guy got his balls cut off. Let's throw it in the camera and fucking like into the audience. You know,
but here's the beautiful thing. Here's the beautiful thing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the fact that it doesn't reveal the kills is that this was released in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
1975 came out another movie that had a notoriously a killer that we didn't see until the very end of the movie, known as Jaws.
Right.
And part of me wonders if, in fact, Texas Chainsaw Massacre helped in the inspiration, other than a non-working shark, of course, that helps Steven Spielberg basically save Jaws, by using this kind of not seeing the killer, not seeing the violence outright, but seeing the aftermath. In fact, I want to say that Jaws has even more violence and gore, which is a PG movie, than the X-rated at the time Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I was trying to go for a PG, but I got a rated X.
Poor guy.
It's really impressive when you think about it. It's like, we're going for PG. Here's X. What?
But at the same time, though, considering the fact that you don't see any gore, that is the highest compliment that you could ever receive. Because basically, you convinced audiences all over the world that they saw a lot more than they really did.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful. That is the greatest compliment you can give a film. But, okay, one other thing we talked about Franklin, though. What do we think about these other kids? Are there any of these kids that we like?
Well, I was going to say that, like, the other kids in the van, they can leave Franklin's ass. We have to stay with them, you know? They can go down to that swimming hole.
Well, they did leave his ass. I mean, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Sally.
When he gets annoying, they can just, like, go off and, oh, we're going to go for a walk. A walk, Franklin. You know, like that. And just fucking.
They went into, like, ditches that he couldn't go.
Yeah.
Like, they found.
See you later. You know, just fucking.
But.
They're all awful. All of them.
No.
Yeah.
They are obnoxious at times. But at the same time, though, they're just freaking kids. You know? They don't do anything that's completely outright cruel. They just, they goof off. They're having fun with one another. Even Franklin, to an extent, he's annoying. But at the same time, though, I mean, if you were in his position, wouldn't you be a little resentful? You know, it's not exactly like he can go everywhere he wants to go. It's not as though that he can do the things that they can do. And so part of me is kind of, conflicted about how I feel about Franklin, considering that, he is extremely annoying, especially at the end. But at the same time, he was the one that was fucking right. He was telling Sally, no, we need to get the fuck out of here. Of course, he said to go back to the gas station, which, of course, as we find out later in the film, wouldn't have helped at all.
No.
But seriously, though, right? I mean, he really did call it right.
Yeah.
You gotta give him that. Gotta give him that. As annoying as he is.
I'm glad he got one thing right out of the dozen things he got wrong.
Yeah.
Well, he, you know.
Well, to defend every, so if nobody has any idea that anything bad is really happening, you're gonna make those decisions.
Well, what reason would you believe that there would be anything wrong that's going to happen here? One of the beautiful things about what I love about this film is there is no reason whatsoever to believe that anything bad is going to happen. There's no ominous feeling. So with the exception of the harbinger of death, that is the guy who basically set them up for the kill to begin with.
Why pick up a hitchhiker? Come on, you guys. What are you doing?
It's the 60s, it's the 50s, you know, it's only fair, and especially on a hot day, you don't want to have that on your conscience.
They saw him, they're talking about him as he gets in the fucking van, they know that shit's gonna go bad. Fucking Dracula over here.
Well, okay, okay, let's go ahead and let's talk about the hitchhiker. Now, when we talk about the hitchhiker, we kind of have to talk about the sequel, the remake, a little bit here, because there's a big difference here, right? In the original, it's a full on psychopath. He's a part of the family. Basically, it ties it together, even though they weren't exactly. He didn't set them on the direction that they were going, but at the same time, that you can kind of understand why their paths would interconnect, considering the fact that they're out there. The reason why they're out there to begin with, right, is because a cemetery had been desecrated, and I guess we're led to believe that it was the hitchhiker that was the one that desecrated, right?
Yeah.
He was ultimately the one who did it. They were out there because their grandfather was buried in that cemetery, and they just wanted to make sure that he wasn't one of the ones that was that was desecrated, right? That was the real reason why they were there. From there, they decide they're going to check on the house, you know, the old family house, just to kind of make sure that everything is all right. Or at least that was what Franklin kind of wanted, right? Just kind of check it out and then just move on. If I'm wrong, please let me know.
That sounds right. Yeah.
So, considering the fact that the cannibal family lives one door down, literally, that would lead us to believe, especially considering that the hitchhiker, being one of the cannibal family, would be going back home, because apparently he wanted to look at kind of all the fuss. You know, he wanted to take pride in his work, right? That was why he was there. So when they're bringing him home, or before he decides to tear up Franklin, were you a little happy about that, Chris? Were you happy that the hitchhiker slashed up Franklin a little bit?
I was more happy with the chainsaw.
Yeah.
Yes, well, you don't hear Franklin going, ow, ow, ow.
Sally, wait. Yeah.
Well, if it makes you feel better, even the actor who played Franklin hated Franklin. All right.
So, wait, if they lived next door, just random thought, wouldn't they have smelled, like, the meat and the blood and the carcasses? Because there was a lot of them. There was a lot.
They live near a meatpacking plant.
Not a meatpacking plant, but
a slaughterhouse.
Right.
Remember the whole point of the smell?
Right. Yeah. Okay. I forgot about that.
So
if they're a couple acres away, it is blowing.
It's not about a couple acres. You have to understand, one thing that I kind of have a little first-hand experience, my grandparents used to live near a slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
You can smell that for about 5 miles. It is strong, especially considering where the wind blows.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, it's not just the carcass, but manure.
Ooh. Yeah. That would cover
it. Yum.
Yep. So that like I said, the way that the attention to detail that this film has in the small details, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Fargo when we were discussing kind of the based on true events
that we had
about that movie. Now, bear in mind that there were kind of true events based on Texas Chainsaw Massacre. A little bit.
Isn't it
very, very loose?
Yeah.
Yes.
One, it wasn't Texas.
Where was it, Kent?
Wasn't it Minnesota?
Or was it Wisconsin? I'm not correct. I thought it was Indiana.
No, I said it was Minnesota, Wisconsin. Well, I thought it was up north.
Well, we actually talked about this same case twice before in both of Art House of Horrors with Silence of the Lambs and Psycho. Yeah. Ed Gein, actually, I think you're right. It was the Minnesota man.
Yeah.
Minnesota. But yeah, Ed Gein is the one of the influences behind this. The fact that he would cannibalize and use the parts that he didn't eat for for various variety of
household materials.
Nipple belts. Nipple belts and lampshade made of skin.
Yep,
and we got lampshades of skin on this one too. That was a little freaky.
The couch was nice.
Before we get into the truly genuinely horrific elements, let's talk about kind of the fact that almost half of the film, even if I want to say about the 2/3 of the film, is done in pure daylight.
Yeah.
How is this different from other horror films prior and even horror films that happen afterward?
Daylight is like sanctuary in most horror movies. Yeah. Nighttime is where the killers strike. This kind of reverses that and then kind of just says, fuck it, and it happens all the fucking time.
Well, also, nighttime to high mistakes if you right. don't show yeah. a lot.
Horror usually is about what you don't see. And night is a great place to hide things, because when you remove light, you don't, you can't see it, obviously. I mean, most horror films use nighttime because night is the time of horror. Night is the time of when things occur. Usually it's overnight when things happen. For it to happen during the day. And to me, that's one of the beautiful things about any kind of film that is willing to even try doing horror during the day. Very few films will ever try doing that. But for this particular film, and considering that this is really the opener, this is the first the first slasher film. Let's go ahead and let's just call it. This is the first slasher film to happen mostly during the day, where the initial kills happen during the day.
Yeah.
I mean, all but two are killed during the day. Let's keep that in mind. I mean, that is saying something. And the fact that even like with the first kill, it comes out of fucking nowhere.
Yeah.
No setup, no indicator, no scary music. It's like, we're coming up to this door. Door opens. Freaky guy comes out, hits him over the head, and charts him off. Simple as that. In fact, we don't get the freaking chainsaw until, about, halfway through the film?
Yep.
Leatherface uses the sledgehammer on one. He puts one girl on the hook.
Hook, yeah.
After a bear hug. From behind.
Yeah. Right. which I've seen that GIF turned into a GIF before. And
some
it's
classic
just,
GIFs, yeah.
It's, yeah.
But I mean, yeah, we don't even see the chainsaw until later on into the film. And one of the things that I admire about this is the fact that with every kill that we have in this, it looks authentic. When someone is screaming in pain, we understand why they're screaming in pain. It looks fucking painful, even when we don't even fucking see it, like with the meat hook. We see from behind Leatherface. We never see see her getting actually pinned, right?
Yeah, you see her hanging there, but you don't see the actual penetration of the hook in the skin, right? Yeah.
And they originally wanted it pop out front, looked in. One, we're going for a G rating. Two, we don't have the effects budget. Not sure how to do that, so.
Oh, no. If you actually seen the hook coming out of her, this is another one of those elements where I think that the movie would have been fucking banned.
Yeah.
Not just like scorned, but freaking banned. It wouldn't have gotten a New York release. Mm. I mean, let's be honest here. Up to this particular point, we've never seen violence of this particular level, whether it's even with implied violence. Like whenever we look at Psycho, he used a knife to kill people. He didn't torture them. There was no sustained torture. He just come out, he slashed them, he killed them, and bada bing. Even the Night of the Living Dead, they fed on you, true. We only saw one scene of that though. They carted you off, they killed you, and then stripped you apart. No, there was no lingering violence. There was no torture. It was done, right? And the only reason why this isn't really considered torture is, what is Leatherface's intention for these kids. Is he intending to torture them?
No, he wants to put meat on the table, literally. So,
yeah,
that's it.
And use the remains for useful household items.
Yeah.
And this is where I let's talk about Leatherface for a second here. Because out of everything that you said, what exactly is Leatherface? Think about it. He cooks, he cleans, he builds things.
Are you saying he's a wife?
Well, have you noticed another thing about his dress? Namely, that he is actually wearing a dress and an apron?
I mean, I realized first... at the end he's wearing a mask with makeup on it. I didn't notice the dress, yeah.
Our first slasher is also our first transgendered slasher.
Well, are you sure?
No, because they said your brother. So
it does say your brother. Yeah.
So he is definitely a male. He is played by Gunnar Hansen, also a male.
Yeah.
Does he ever go full-blown transgender? I think he did in, like, Next Generation, right? Wasn't he, like, wearing women's clothing
Next
in that?
Next Generation, I don't think so. I think they kind of toned that down because they thought that it was going too far. But here's the thing about Leatherface as a transgender person. That doesn't change his character at all. He's not any different.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, other than the fact, he's stronger than the women that he puts on the hook. But at the same time, though, he doesn't just go after women, though. We've seen that his first kill is a man. In fact, he's equal opportunity because meat is meat. Doesn't matter if it comes from a man or a woman, right? Even Sally, our final girl, they're not treating her any real differently, right?
The rest of the family seems to be tricky. He doesn't seem to be in.
But at the same time, though, one of the funny things that I love about this movie is the fact that Pa, you know, our gas station attendant, he's like, he doesn't like actually killing. That's why he allows Leatherface to do it, because he's the one who seems to have a skill for it, right? But at the same time, though, it seems like they keep sending him off to the kitchen. So basically, he is, in fact, the wife.
I just imagine him in there with, like, this piece of skin all rolled out with, like, a rolling pin. He's, like, using, like, the cookie cutter things on there to, like, make cookies out of skin.
Yeah. But I mean, look at it, though. I mean, look at how Leatherface acts throughout the film. He doesn't act like a psychopath. He acts like someone that's protecting his home. You know, you have these strange people coming into the house. What are you going to do with them? Especially if, you know, basically you see anyone like that as meat.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you look at it that way, he's a perfectly functioning housewife. In fact, I would say that he's probably the most normal of the, if you were to go by the standard of the time of what you would consider to be a normal household, Leatherface is the quintessential housewife, right? Although I have to admit, though, the Vanity Fair photo spread of that would have been amazing. Oh, come on. You know that you would do it.
Would there be recipes in that issue, too?
We'll get Anne Leibowitz to come out there. You know, she'll take photos. We'll make it a whole spread, right?
Was this family actually inbred, or do we have a backstory on that? Anywhere?
They don't actually outright say it, but it's pretty clear that, especially considering the malformed nature of this family, it isn't outright said, but it's pretty much implied that they're inbred.
I mean, maybe they weren't inbred. There was a toxic coldness somewhere nearby.
I don't know. If you're going to play that up, then you would definitely do so. But at the same time, we're also looking at 1974. We didn't have a whole lot of environmental issues that were coming up at that particular point. But we did have the Vietnam War playing a part into it. We also had, it was the first kind of major trend towards veganism, which I want to say that Tobe Hooper was kind of, that he did kind of turn vegan at this particular point to an extent, and that he was making this a commentary on carnivores specific and meat eaters. Or do you kind of see that, or do you think that maybe there's a little bit of a stretch?
No, I could see it as a pro or anti discussion.
In fact, PETA did call this to be one of the most influential films towards vegetarianism, right? I mean, I will say, though, that if I were a very sensitive meat eater, I'd probably turn vegan after watching this. Even though you don't actually see them actually get turned into meat, just the implication, though.
when you mentioned Vietnam, I was wondering, was a vet. No. Maybe that's why he was in the chair.
I got the sense that he, I mean, they don't want to say why he's in a wheelchair, but he definitely comes off as slow. So I would probably say that there was some sort of motor sensory deterioration occurring. But yeah, I don't see him. I don't even think he would be able to pass the physical for wartime. Oh, what do you think, Chris?
I don't want to say what I think. So I'm going to say something bad about him, and it's just going to haunt me forever.
Oh, don't probably. Stop now.
Go for the kill.
I don't know. I mean, I kind of got the impression he was handicapped from birth. Like, okay. Yeah. Just something they said. It wasn't like a direct thing, but just like the way they said it, it made me feel like he had always been in a wheelchair. Always had trouble walking or, you know, whatever. So, I mean, I didn't think much of it after that.
No, you probably got a point there. And I kind of get the same sense as well, to be honest. But at the same time, though, he definitely has deficiencies that would have kept him from warfare.
Well, he's a whiz with that pocket knife, I'll tell you that.
If he'd been had the pocket knife out when Leatherface showed up, he could have
taken it. Epic sword fight, pocket knife, chainsaw, yeah.
Also, let's go ahead and let's talk about the other members of the Cannibal family. We did talk about the hitchhiker, we did talk about Leatherface, but what do we think about the other members here, especially Pa and Grandpa?
What the fuck is the point of Grandpa?
He has to own the store that sells them.
He shits himself, and that's it.
I love Grandpa. I love the fact that he is definitely the patriarch, that he holds a place of esteem in this family. You know, he was the best killer in the house, although he's so old right now. I don't even know if he's alive.
I thought he was dead. I thought he was just a corpse.
Well, this is what I love about him, like when they're trying to get him to hit her on the back of the head.
Yeah,
and he just drops it.
No motor skills, you know. This shit is gone. It's a puddle.
That's kind of why I thought he was dead. Was like they were moving his limbs for him and couldn't do it. And any movement we saw was a hallucination or the actor going oops, cupping or something.
But did anyone else find that scene funny? I mean, there is something that's genuinely funny about how this family is behaving in this. I mean, it's horrific. I mean, we are kind of feeling for Sally, but at the same time, there's just something genuinely goofy about this scene, right?
It's like, eat your dinners with you, and Grandpa's going to kill you. What?
I love this scene. I also at the same time though, look at how this family responds to one another. Pa pretty much is the law, right? He's the father. Leatherface is the mother. The hitchhiker is what, the son, and Grandpa is the patriarch. You know, he's the old coot, right?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, this is pretty much a nuclear family, a family of the six. Do you kind of see that?
Leatherface stays
at home. She's pretty much, you know, she's cooking, she's cleaning, she's making sure that everything is all right. She takes care of everybody. You know, you have Pa that's off at work at the gas station. You have the hitchhiker, which is, you know, your kid that's going out and playing, you know, and Grandpa's off in his own room.
With the right? of Grandma.
Dying a little bit more each and every day.
Yeah.
No, Grandma's dead. We saw Grandma's corpse.
Grandma's.
Oh, I thought you said Grandpa. Sorry.
Well, Grandpa. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Grandpa's dying, but at the same time, I mean, how old is he?
I mean, like Mr. Burns' age, I think. Yeah.
But there's something out there. I don't want to talk about the finale until we talk about the first time that Sally escapes. You know, from Leatherface. Because after Franklin gets killed, and I have to admit, there's something kind of gangster about the way that Leatherface uses a chainsaw. Because literally, we go from hearing the chainsaw rev up to, you know, butchered Franklin in like 0.5 seconds. I mean, anyone who's ever done a chainsaw knows it takes a while to rev that thing up. So Leatherface has got some chainsaw skill, right?
He ninja'd that stealth of that thing. He just came out of nowhere. It was awesome. It was like super quiet, and then this fucking like out of nowhere, they're like just fucking rah! Just, yeah.
Well, especially considering that Sally and Franklin are both screaming the entire time.
Yeah.
But that's the beautiful thing about this movie, is the fact that prior to this time, I mean, yeah, we know that Leatherface is out there, right? But the thing is that there is no reason for Sally and Franklin to think that there's anything violent out there, right? I mean, yeah, their friends are missing, but we don't believe that it's because of anything violent. For all we know, it could be a snake, or it could be that they got lost, right? I mean, there's no indication, no reason for them to be worried that there's violence out there. Y'all see that, or am I reading this differently?
Well, they keep saying it's just a straight path everywhere. It's just easy to find. It's like,
well, is that exactly those woods?
Yeah.
I mean, outside of a creek bed, it's all flat territory. You can pretty much see for miles, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's why they say, yeah, it's just a straight point. Between those two sheds, yeah, you'll find the creek. Yeah, you go here, you're going to find this. But one thing I did find very interesting is how we're introduced to the cannibal family's household is that we first hear an engine, right? Yeah. You know, a generator engine. We find cars that have been kind of parked in this kind of garage kind of thing, or maybe kind of a graveyard of sorts, right? Because they're eating the people.
Parking
we get the sense that this cannibal family is basically killing hitchhikers. Or not hitchhikers, but
tourists.
You know, killing people who get lost.
People who pass through. Anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe Paw is directing them that direction, right? Which is interesting considering that he's the one who's telling them, oh, you don't want to be going out there. Do you think that maybe he was trying to reverse psychology, use reverse psychology and get them to go out there? Or do you think that he was basically saying, no, you don't want to go out there?
Kind of. I don't know. Seems like he's not quite smart to begin reverse psychology, but then he may be practical enough to go, if I tell kids not to do something, they'll do it. So, therefore, don't go.
Well, I mean, he seems to change a different opinion of them when he finds out that the house that they're going out to is a family home.
Yeah.
Do you think that might be playing a part of the reason for his, like, oh, don't go out there? Is that he sees them as local, even when they're not?
Or they could be some bizarre, weird relationship. It was all being area.
We're not going to go kill family.
How many generations back. Yeah, could be. Could be like 4 or 5 generations ancestors.
Well, maybe so.
I mean,
well, one thing I find very interesting here is this is something that films prior and even films after this don't really take account. There's no sexual tension between the cannibals and the characters, you know, the victims.
Oh, no.
Even Sally, there's nothing really sexual. I mean, I guess the hitchhiker does kind of take a kind of a like to her, but we don't get any kind of rapey elements to it, right?
Well, I mean, the only thing you have to do is literally them.
You know, don't play
you.
With
I'll
your food, son.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go. But again, I mean, that's very unique, especially in horror films, because how many horror films have we seen, even for Art House of Horror, that have used some sort of sexual tension? I mean, most of them, I would say, right? There's either a kind of a romantic interest, or even with like the victims and the violator, there's some sort of sexual tension. I mean, hell, we talked about Nightmare on Elm Street a couple of years ago, where even though it was supposedly a child killer, he's going after a teenager, very ripe teenager. They're in the midst of their own sexual awakenings, right?
I don't think that's such. I think that's just opportunity.
Unless, of course, you think that perhaps that, and this was even used in the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street, that he was a sexual predator that killed his victims afterwards, and that was perhaps implied.
Well, we did see it in
that too.
Yeah.
I thought that was something interesting to kind of take into account. But let's talk about Sally. We kind of danced around it, but Sally is a very unique protagonist here, right? Because she's not a damsel in the least, right? She doesn't really need saving, so to say, or at least from a main character. You know, she's when she finds herself in, you know, in harm's way, she's pretty capable, right?
Yeah, well,
I mean, she can run around.
Freak out. Yeah.
Well, let me put it this way. She doesn't even think twice about jumping out of a window that's on the second floor. I mean, she doesn't even think twice. She just like runs out of it like a freaking stunt person.
She's the juggernaut, bitch, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, and she's willing to hit the ground running and, you know, just, yeah, she, I gotta give it to Sally. She is definitely a survival-minded individual. She, when she puts on her survival cap, she's freaking stronger than, I even think that she thinks she is. Because, you know, like, after Franklin gets killed, she is able to get away from Leatherface. And one of the beautiful things about, I have to give credit to the sound effects here, because it's completely dark, right? We can barely see anything, specifically our main protagonist, yet we hear that chainsaw.
Yep.
We know that chainsaw is around. And that puts the fear in us, right? That's the beautiful thing about having a chainsaw as the weapon of choice. Because in the dark, you just hear that thing and you know what that thing can do. Right?
Yep.
So every time that she's running, it's like at any point she can come across that chainsaw, and we're just worried that's going to happen. So that when she finally gets to the gas station, you know, we kind of feel comfort. We also feel comfort because what's the one thing that we get with the gas station?
Shelter.
Light.
Night. Yeah.
The use of natural lighting in this movie is amazing, because they could have used day for night. They could have used blue filters. They could have made it so that we saw everything. But no, they made it very clear that when she's running in dark, she's in dark. She can barely see anything. So she gravitates towards light. When she sees the light of the gas station, she runs straight for it. And she feels comfortable when she gets into that light. And when she has, when she's at with the gas station attendant, we feel comfortable because we know that, especially with that chainsaw out in the dark, what is out there, right? It's this Jaws again, right?
The master chainsaw.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about having a chainsaw as a weapon. But at the same time, though, when that's taken away from us, when Paul reveals himself and she and he's able to subdue her and to take her home, right? Where the light betrays us at this particular point. And I also find it very interesting that when we get to the dinner table scene, which is considered to be one of the most iconic scenes in the film. What did y'all think about this dinner scene?
It's bizarre. You know, it kind of reminded me of Rocky Horror Picture Show, which it wouldn't surprise me if it were from this. So.
Well, if I'm not correct, Rocky Horror came out in 1972. So this was
Texas. Well, okay, stage show in 1972. So even then the movie is 1976. So.
Perhaps.
Yeah, but if play was this. Okay.
Well, I mean, the film could have taken a deviation towards this film. And bear in mind that considering that was an homage to horror, the horror films prior to Texas Chainsaw, I'm pretty sure that they might have made kind of a nod to this film to just acknowledge that, yeah, it was, yeah, you know, this exists.
The movie is 70.
All right, so 1 year.
Yeah, so probably not existed today.
And they didn't have a shark in the movie, so.
Yeah.
It's one flaw. One flaw, you know.
One flaw. All movies are better than sharks.
Oh, Sci-Fi Channel believes in that motto.
This is true.
All right. Let's get back to this. So, again, this whole sequence at the dinner table, especially with Grandpa, especially with the there's something kind of weird and funny and horrific and dark about this particular scene, considering that we're kind of laughing at the fact that Grandpa can't seem to get the death kill. We're hearing Sally screaming and crying, and that's affecting our enjoyment of this particular scene a little bit. Yet at the same time, she's still capable of taking advantage of the situation, right?
Yeah.
The fact that we saw her jump out of a second story window. She fucking barrels through another window after this scene. But I will say one thing, considering the fact that when she jumps out of that window, it is dawn. Does that mean that they're literally having dinner at 5 in the morning?
5, 6 a.m.?
Does that mean that this place is like an IHOP or something?
For three people, yeah. Well, four,
I just want to put that image out there of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre about the most fucked up IHOP ever to exist.
Well, I've heard.
And that's an image you're not going to be able to take back.
I've heard of legends of what happens at houses 4 a.m., so I'm not going to question it.
Oh, God.
I don't have a Waffle House around me. Just heard things. So.
Well, there goes our Waffle House endorsement. Thank you very much.
Ah.
But again, the one thing I love about this is that when she jumps out that window and it's light again, we're at dawn. Again, this is the time when our heroes are supposed to be the safest. You know, they made it through the night. And this is where her ultimate challenge is about to begin. She's not safe yet. Right?
It's time to run a marathon from a guy running with a chainsaw.
Well, she does have, she definitely has the legs on her to carry her. But I also love the fact that not only does she make it to dawn, she makes it to the fucking highway! And she's still not safe! You know, she flags, you know, she gets the hitchhiker. The hitchhiker catches up to her. They have that fight in the freeway. Alright, did anyone get an Austin Powers vibe when the hitchhiker got hit by the semi? No! No.
That's become its own kind of trope now. That's just so funny. It's like,
I couldn't stop thinking of Austin Powers at that scene at all. That was, but at the same time though, again, she gets into the truck. They're supposed to be safe. Yet yep. Leatherface comes out and uses the chainsaw, right? I mean, they're still not safe. They're in the freaking, in most other films, this is safety. You know, there's no reason for her to be worried, right?
It's home base. Now, granted, when he went after with the chainsaw, why didn't the trucker just slam in the gear and the accelerator?
There's a guy with a chainsaw that's trying to tear through your door. Like,
out the other side might not be a good idea. But
well, what else are you gonna do with a guy that's about to put a chainsaw through your door? There's a leg that's right there.
Well,
I mean,
most of the truckers I know would go, why reach over and grab my gun? Which, yeah, why doesn't this trucker? So,
well, maybe, yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe he didn't own a gun. Or, you know, maybe he was, like, too afraid. You know, he's one of those kind of guys that would use the gun every chance he got, so he decided not to have it in his thing. But one thing I love about this, one element, so here again, we have a damsel in distress situation, right? She finds the trucker's supposed to be there. He's kind of the woodsman, right? If we were to look at this as like Little Red Riding Hood, right? So this could be the woodsman that comes to save the day. Nope, he goes running right behind her, right? I mean, in fact, we don't even know what his fate is at the end of the film. I mean, she finds another truck and she jumps in, but the other trucker, that trucker's like, he's left with a psychopath, you know, attacking his truck, right?
That's trucking too.
I'm hoping he drove away while Leatherface was dancing in the street. So yeah.
I'm hoping so too. The guy is actually trying to protect her. He's worried about her more than he is about his own safety. I mean, this is, you know, it's not like he's putting his own safety in front of hers. He's not kicking her out like, well, if you get rid of this crazy lady, then, you know, maybe I can get the psychopath off me. No, he's actually worried about her. Even though he's like in the movie for, what, 5 seconds? I mean, literally, I think it is 5 seconds. I think that's all the screen time they have for him. But when she does finally get into the pickup truck, and the pickup truck is driving far away, what do we take of the scene? What do you take of her kind of laughing the way she does?
Relief, disbelief, that it's over, you know, but she can't believe it.
For now, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's victorious?
Just that the hell is finally over. Kind of like a victorious thing, yeah.
So what are we to make of Leatherface's dance of despair and chainsaw?
Temper tantrum because one got away.
How does that make you feel about Leatherface? Considering how impending Leatherface has been throughout the film, does that change how you look at Leatherface from being kind of this methodical killer? The fact that he's willing to throw a temper tantrum with a chainsaw of all things?
Well, especially really. After the chainsaw actually hit him in the leg earlier.
Walked it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trooper.
How many times do you think Leatherface has had an accident with that chainsaw?
Oh, none of those fingers are real on his hand. Those are all gone.
So, you know, he basically pulled an Ash?
Yeah.
Now, honestly, though, how awesome would it have been if we had an Ash versus Leatherface sequence? Don't worry, at some point we will actually get to that. Although I have a feeling we're going to have to do a double feature for that one. But the fact that this is the final sequence, the fact that Leatherface isn't actually defeated, he's just kind of, you know, we don't actually see Leatherface get reprimanded, but the fact that he just lost her, right? She got away. And that's actually one of the reasons why it took 26 years for this movie to get a release in Britain. The fact that that Leatherface didn't get a comeuppance, that is...
It's weird.
What are you...
Well, they're already thinking a sequel, so...
Well, considering the fact that it took until the 80s to get one. Or maybe it was 78, or was it 80?
No, it's 80s.
Well, one thing about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was it wasn't done by the same production company. Oh, no. We got Canon Films to deal with that movie. And anyone who's ever seen Electric Boogaloo, you know what I'm talking about. Oh, God. Oh, at some point, we'll have to talk about Canon. We'll have to at some point. I don't know how, considering that all of their movies are pretty much shit, but we will have to talk about it. We do have a month where we talk about, you know, bad movies. So, yeah. But I guess my next movie, my next question is, considering the end of this particular film, would you have preferred a direct sequel to the events of this movie? Other than if you've ever seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, to what it does in that film?
I haven't seen 2, so I don't need Zimation 2 a sequel here. Mm-hmm. So I just assumed by the sequel, all the bad guys got away. After the sheriff raided the house, it was like, oh, there was mass murder, but everybody go.
Actually, you're right. That's exactly what happened.
It's like, okay. Which, I mean, they've gotten cards they couldn't away.
But here's the let's put it this way. Whenever I find myself asking, if I were to do a direct sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the first one, how would you do it? And for me, I would have gone kind of like the Halloween 2 thing, which was to set the movie about 3 hours later. The cops are coming out to this farm and basically kind of have it as a siege movie. Again, have it done in daylight. Have it so that, you know, the family's prepared for the cops and that they're going to take out as many of them as they can. And just to make it interesting, make it so that we're actually rooting for the family. They're outnumbered. They force, you know, maybe have like a really bad sheriff, you know, one that we can kind of like really not like, and have it so that we're kind of rooting for the bad guy.
Well, are you talking about if the sequel were back in the 70s or a sequel were today?
Yeah.
Okay. Because a sequel today, you'd have every, what? You're rooting for the bad guys killing innocent police officers. And,
like, or they'd give some...
Oh, no. Technically speaking, that's kind of what we got with Texas Chainsaw 3D.
Ah, okay.
Actually, what I just mentioned, spoiler alert, kind of was Texas Chainsaw 3D, now that I think about it. But, yeah, maybe I should have thought about that.
Yeah.
All right. Anything we want to talk about before we get into Geek Sheet? Any aspects that you felt we haven't touched on?
Music, maybe?
All right, so what did you think about the music in this particular film?
Didn't they just use sounds from the slaughterhouse instead of actual music?
Well, actually, there was it was a very experimental soundtrack, but it wasn't all stuff that you would find in a slaughterhouse. It was a whole bunch of different instruments. Toby Hooper pretty much did the score himself using kind of different types of objects. The one that always kind of gets me is the sound of the Polaroid kind of thing. When you see the flashes at the beginning of the film, it sets such a great tone. And especially the way that they use that for, you know, kind of seeing, because ultimately the opening of the film is what the cops saw after the events. You know, the whole point of this was kind of a flashback to the events of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And they kind of already implied that these events have already passed, that whatever happened, that it's coming to light, right? And the way that they use that sound, that kind of haunting Polaroid sound, I think is the best way to put it, just kind of sets up this kind of eerie element to it. Do you agree, or what did you think of that sound?
Oh, it's iconic. So it was so good that they used it for the remake, so...
Yeah.
The real tragedy is that use of chainsaws as a musical instrument had not fully been realized when this movie was made.
Well, technically speaking, what is a chainsaw but a bicycle chain that's attached to a motor that is revved up to an incredible amount of speed? So basically, you're just hearing a motor That's what a chainsaw is, with the exception of whatever the chain touches that it's tearing into, right? See, that's the beauty of the chainsaw as a weapon and as a sound effect, is that it's simplistic in what a chainsaw does, what it intends to, what you can use a chainsaw for. It's to tear. It's to rip.
Yeah.
It's to pulverize. Normally wood, but in this case, flesh.
Yeah.
Have any opinions on this, Chris?
It just kind of reminds me of, do either guys watch Preacher?
I haven't.
I too.
Okay, so watch Preacher. Anybody listen to this, watch Preacher. It's amazing. Okay. Jackie Earle Haley's character listens to the sounds of cows being slaughtered at a slaughterhouse in the first season, like whenever he's by himself. Reminds me of that. It's awesome.
Okay.
It's very weird.
Honestly, very I wouldn't good. Be surprised if Jackie Earle Haley actually listened to that just
right?
for fun.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I love me some Jackie Earle Haley. I love Jackie Earle Haley, but damn it, that guy just doesn't give off a vibe of being like one twisted fuck. And hopefully he finds that to be very to flattering, because he does follow me on Twitter.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
Cool. Only other thing I can toss out chainsaws is, like, every time I say chainsaw, I want to call it a chainsword, because I've got a bunch of space marines on chainswords.
Then you're really going to love Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, because we actually get a chainsaw fight!
Yeah!
And a shark! No, I'm kidding.
With none other than Dennis Hopper. There you go. All right, anything else we want to bring up? Kent, do you have a geek sheet for us?
Not like it, a lot of people who were in this film didn't do much later, except our voiceover at the beginning, who I did not recognize, and I'm reading the credits, I'm like, no.
Oh, you mean Dan Fielding of Night Court?
Yeah.
John Larroquette did the opening, and it's like, wait, what? Like, young John Larroquette just read this thing and doesn't appear. And it's like, whoa, how did he? I kind of want to know how he got this. It's just way of reading. And then I rewatched just the beginning section, listening. It's like, yeah, I could kind of see that. So,
all right, I have a few. If you have none others. All right, so obviously we have Tobe Hooper, who did direct this particular movie, as well as a few other well-known movies, including a little Spielberg film called Poltergeist, as well as Life Force, which is a kind of a... It didn't get a whole lot of love, considering we're talking about canon films again, but in my opinion, it's great, and it also stars Patrick Stewart, so you got that. Basically, it's space vampires. Naked Sphinx vampires at that. So, there you go. Enjoy. But also, we did talk about the actors not really having done much, with the exception of Gunnar Hansen, who did return back for Texas Chainsaw, to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre a couple of other times. He's also kind of a documentary filmmaker as well. For the most part, you know, he's pretty much known in the horror circles, kind of an icon, obviously for being Leatherface, but he's also done a few other things. I will talk about the behind the scenes people, because one that I was really surprised, I didn't even realize it was that guy until this time around. But one of the production manager for this film is Ron Bozeman. Are you familiar with Ron Bozeman? We actually talked about him before. He was one of the producers of a little movie called The Silence of the Lambs.
Okay.
He's a big friends and producer for pretty much all of Jonathan Demme's work. He is, and he's worked with Tom Hanks a great deal as well, with his work as well. But yeah, Ron Bozeman went from being production designer for Chainsaw Massacre and became a producer in the 80s specifically. And all the way up until recently. His last film was a movie called Patterson with Kylo Ren.
Oh.
Bet you didn't know that one. Anyway, that's pretty much it on my end. The others are lower end. But are we ready to call it, or anything else we want to talk about? Well, let's do this. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris?
I always go back and forth with it, because like I said, like when I go for long periods of time where I don't watch it, I feel like I hate it more than I do. And then I watch it and I actually enjoy it for just like, it's its portrayal of gore and lack thereof, yet still ability to be terrifying, like to stand, you know, 40 plus years so far. You know, it's amazing. So, yeah, it's a pass for me.
Kent.
For me, this movie, I would say if you're a fan of horror, history of horror, and history of slasher, you go for this film. If you're actually just, like, plotting out events in cinema that's changed anything, this is a go-to. If you're squeamish like me and going, oh god, I don't look, then don't watch it. But otherwise, I'm going to give this a pass. Almost gave a maybe, but because I'm mostly just because I'm squeamish. So. Yeah.
Not a big fan of the slasher genre?
No.
Boo.
That's
boo.
Okay.
Yeah.
You can join it for Saw.
Just the first one. We won't make you watch all seven. So
I'll find somebody else for Saw.
I don't
Saw.
Even know if any of the Saws would actually meet the criteria, so you might have caught a break on that.
How long is the first Saw? Is
it?
Well, we'll talk about that end. But
early
2005? Okay.
It's like early 2000s. Yeah.
Okay. So we got over, like, 8 years.
Oh, there you go. All right. With that said, though, when it comes to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's one of those movies that I admired it more than I probably liked it the first time that I saw it, just because of how the film was able to do so much on such a small budget. Bear in mind that this film was basically made for about $120. Or, no, I'm sorry, $120,000. And half of that money was
beer.
Basically mob money. And yeah, that's a whole different story in itself. That said, the movie itself is incredible. With an 80-minute runtime, it runs fast. There's not a moment that, with the exception of probably the beginning of the film where you're trying to establish characters, and kind of setting up, not so much, that you like the characters, but that there's no danger. It sets up time so that you just are lulled into a sense of security until Leatherface comes out and starts whacking people. And by that particular point, it is startling. It is set up very efficiently so that when things start to happen, it starts slowly, but then it takes a breakneck speed and it never stops. And to me, that's something that's very impressive. And while the characters aren't the most likable, the situation is, you know, I think we talked about with Fargo, kind of that, you know, at that point where you believe and disbelieve. It dances on that line a bit, especially with, you know, Sally going through not just one, but two fucking windows and being able to run like a track star. But that said, though, by that point, you care about her. You care that she survives. And she is likable to an extent, unlike her brother, Franklin. But at the same time, though, you also kind of feel for the family. The family, ultimately, you know, they didn't ask for these idiots to come to their house. Yeah, they were going to, yeah, they eat people who just happen to find their way. So I guess they kind of see them as animals to their own extent, which is horrific on one level. But if you look at it from their perspective, you know, well, you're meat, you're on our property, you know, stand your ground. But ultimately, though, I think this movie is fascinating. I think it's done in a great way. I think that for the time frame, it doesn't waste time getting to where it's trying to go. And while the acting is pretty low and the production design, the production is extremely independent, I absolutely adore it. I think that this inventive, fun, and terrifying. And for an art house of horror film, I can't ask more. So yes, this is a definite pass. I absolutely love this one. So, are we ready to get to the final part of our art house of horror 2017? Kid, what do we have coming up?
Well, according to this sheet and me, we have a independent movie with some actors whose own personal geek sheets are going to
be... Two members of the Star Trek family?
Yes, two people whose geek sheets are going to be longer than... So long, we just mentioned them, so it's over. A movie called Green Room, about a punk band fighting for survival.
Against Nazis. So yes, this is going to be an exciting talk about. And then, of course, don't forget that... Halloween Day, we do have a tendency something a little special
it's
for the
surprise.
Day, so keep, of course, give away that surprise. You have to come back on October 31st to find out about that one.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, though, it is going to be a great one. I cannot wait to share this with you. We have some guests lined up for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. Please join us for that discussion. But until then, though, if you have anything to say about this movie or any of the other films that we talked about for Art House Horror or anything else, you can definitely hit us up on our Facebook page as well as Twitter at Art House Legends. Or if you just want to send us a little, you know, little note, you can email us at arthouselegends@gmail.com. If you want to support our show, you can go on to iTunes, give us a 5-star review. Or if you just want to check out any of our other episodes, the ones that you won't find on iTunes, you can definitely do so at arthouselegends.libsyn.com, and you'll find all 177 episodes there, plus because we release one every week, as well as the ones that we're doing, plus the ones that we're selling there. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And V.
Please leave us a positive review on iTunes.
Music by Kevin MacLeod.
Legends Podcast is not affiliated with any other entity. The opinions stated in this podcast are strictly personal and do not represent the view of its sponsor or any other person or entity. No infringement is intended.